Now, in chapter 4, it leaves the scene of the description of the royal palace and the guard and the beauty and stateliness of the mansion and comes back to the man speaking now. Behold, you're fair, my love. Behold, you're fair. You have dove's eyes within your locks. Your hair is as a flock of goats that appear from Mount Gilead. Now, to people who've never been around goats, that doesn't ring very well, you know. You think, boy, that's some description. A flock of goats. Well, this is a man's description of the quality and culture and beauty of a woman. Now, I don't know how he saw dove's eyes. I've never been able to look at doves that close. You know, I've seen doves before, and I know their eye is black, you know. It's almost, it doesn't have the color of other creatures' eyes, but it's, you know, the way a dove's eyes are in the head and the way a dove blinks its eyes or moves its eyes, if that's what he's talking about here. But his wife's eyes are like that, lively, fiery and alive, and, you know, your eye, the depth of your eye reflects your personality and your life and character. So the character is reflected through the eye, within your locks. You wouldn't be able to say that with a duck tail or something, you know, so she had nice hair, not all the way down to her feet like the Pentecostal ladies do, but her hair was in locks, not straight, but locks. Your hair is a flock of goats that appear from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like the stars, they come out at night. No. You know, I got a card from a minister one time where he had on the front, it showed this man with his shoulders padded, you know, and his very fancy dress and very stately appearance, and, you know, he's real handsome, and it said, happy day, and you opened the inside, and his teeth were out, and his wig was off, and his shoulder pads were off, and here was this little old shrimp of a looking dried up guy. And they had the same type of a card of a woman, you know, that showed her with everything that wasn't herself there, and then you opened the inside and the real woman was there, and any similarity was real imagination, but I used to kid my wife by memorizing a bunch of silly things that kind of made you laugh about the Song of Solomon. But notice the detailed description. You know, in our day, it's easy to say, I love you. I wonder how many people, most people have said that to in their life. You know, it's a lot harder to get detailed, you know, to talk about your wife's smile or her dimples or her beauty mark on the back of her neck, or, you know, you know her in detail, you know. You don't just say, I love you, and that ought to be enough, you know, and, well, look, I told you that yesterday. You know, people don't feel that much like you care that much about them, that you know all about them. So notice, if prayer is beaten up fine, like fine incense, imagine the description of two people loving each other. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep that are even shorn. Now, I can picture that very vividly, because you take a fresh shorn group of sheep, and they're running along in a group, and they do look like teeth that are smooth and even and shiny, like shorn sheep, which came up from the washing, whereof every one bear twins. You know, your teeth are all pairs, two, 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 all the way around. You know, you're not a cyclops with one eye and one tooth and then a mixture or something. But God does things symmetrically, you know. God does things... to me, it'd be hard to imagine somebody with one ear and one eye and one arm and one leg and... You know, that would just be... That wouldn't be symmetrical. But some people's creations are that way. Some buildings men make, they're not harmonious. You know, there's discord, there's conflict, there's not unity or teamwork or parallelism. But look at this. Even teeth are like everyone twins. None is barren among them. Your lips are like a thread of scarlet. You know, they're not 4 inches tall with red, and they're a thread of scarlet. You know, just one little scarlet string. Your speech is comely. Your temples are like a piece of a pomegranate within your locks. Now, if you've seen pomegranate or had a pomegranate in a drink, you know what that's talking about. So he's talking about a healthy look, a real flushed, rosy lips and rosy cheeks and rosy temples. Your neck is like the Tower of David. There's a stateliness or a not a bowed neck of embarrassment or self-consciousness or guilt, but your neck is like the Tower of David building for an army, whereon there hang 1,000 bucklers, all shields of mighty men. So bucklers are just types of shields. Your two breasts are like two young roses that are twins, which feed among the lilies. Now, you know, if people didn't keep the mystery and the secretiveness and the hidden awayness and make things that way, if people just came right out like God always has and been honest and open and frank about things, then maybe man wouldn't be that tempted or that deluded by enticements and things. Your two breasts are like two young roses that are twins. A beautiful thing God created, just like the neck, just like the lips, just like the temples, just like the teeth, just like the hair. Until the day break and the shadows flee away. Now you notice that's going back to what she said back here in verse 17. She's desiring the day of his return, when his job out there is gone and his time to come back to her has come. So now he's longing for that day as well. Until the day break and the shadows flee away, I'll get me to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. You're all fair, my love. There's no spot in you. And of course, that's what Christ meant when the church is going to be without spot or wrinkle or any such thing. It's going to be perfect. Now, that's the way a man ought to feel about a wife, you know. Doesn't mean anybody's perfect. I haven't seen him talking about feet, you know. Feet are ugly. Toes are ugly. I don't know why people want to paint their toes and go around with their bare feet hanging out, you know. Maybe that's acceptable in our world, but boy, you know, in the old world of dignity, that isn't accepted. People wear thongs everywhere. I can't even make myself wear thongs at home, much less everywhere. You know, my feet are ugly, and so are yours. Maybe I'm one ahead of you because I know mine are. And yet the Bible says, beautiful are the feet of those that preach the gospel. So I've got a head start on you there anyway. Well, here he's longing for the time that he can get back to his bride as well and get me to the mountain of myrrh. You ever think about that when you're going home? You're going back to your mountain of myrrh. You're going back to your hill of frankincense. It's the only one that's yours, you know. Any other one is strange. Any other one is foreign. It's kind of interesting when it talks about the strange woman. What does that mean? You ever look up that word, strange woman? You know, in the Hebrew language, it means alien. That's where we get our word alien. It's someone other than the one that's yours. So any other woman except yours is strange, is an alien, strange woman. It's foreign. It's not yours. So here he says, I'm going to get back to my mountain of myrrh and my hill of frankincense. You're all fair, my love. There's no spot in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my spouse. With me from Lebanon. Look from the top of Amana, from the top of Shinar and Hermon. In other words, they're coming on the top mountains of that territory, looking out in all the beauty, and from the lion's dens, from the mountains of the leopards. So apparently they had a place to get away up in the mountains of Lebanon that was a place of the wild animals and the beauty of nature. You've ravished my heart, my sister. That to me never ceases ringing true, where Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9, he said, what about Apollos and I? Don't we have the right to lead about a sister as a wife? Now, that's the perfect picture of marriage. You lead about a sister. You ever think of your wife as a spiritual sister? Well, that's what she is. You lead about a sister as a wife. You don't possess a piece of property. You know, a woman's not a second-rate creature. She's not an afterthought on God's part. She's not a warm body or a second-rate citizen or a second in any way. You know, mankind has brought on himself this woman's lib movement. When you see the way they treat women in the Arab world, or when you see how they treat women in Russia, you know, when you think about the average Russian woman, what do you think about? Well, hard work, or hefty and strong and work. And you don't think of someone that's allowed to venture into the Bible description of beauty and dignity and softness and tenderness. And now, a woman's supposed to be a worker. You know, they're supposed to be vigorous and practical. They're not supposed to be just something to look at, you put up on a pedestal. But look at the extremes in the world about the way they look toward women. You know, in some parts of the world, your women are right next under your camels in importance or in your rating. Well, that's too bad, you know. A woman's made in God's image. She's really made in man's image, and he's made in God's image, so. But notice, you have ravished my heart. You've taken away my heart, my sister, my spouse. You've ravished my heart with one of your eyes. Must have been winking at him and flirting with him and tempting him and teasing him, which is beautiful for a wife to do with a husband. You've taken away my heart, my sister, my spouse. You've taken away my heart with one of your eyes, with one chain of your neck. So necklaces are in good taste if they're appropriate for the size of the woman or the style of the woman or whatever. How fair is your love, my sister, my spouse? How much better is your love than wine? And the smell of your ointments than all spices? Your lips, oh my spouse, drop as the honeycomb. In other words, what she has to say is sweet and nourishing. What she has to say is healthy. You know, honeycomb is one of the healthiest things man can eat. I was laughing at Clayton Steep the other night over at the Apartians, because when he and Bob Steep first came into the church up in Milwaukee, they were going to make the circuit with us one weekend, so we prepared for them. We had locusts and wild honey. And we said, you believe in living by every word of God? Oh, yes. He said, okay, we're going to find out. We got some locusts here, and, well, locusts, what is that? And I said, well, John the Baptist ate locusts, you know, and says back here in other places of the Bible you can eat locusts. So we have a can of locusts here we're going to eat. Oh, boy, they weren't too excited about that. And I said, we got some wild honey here. And so we got this honey and the honeycomb out, and they said, well, you're not going to eat that wax, are you? He said, well, sure you eat that wax. And they never in their life heard about eating beeswax till then. So we chewed it up, and they said, you swallow that? It's like that glue you up inside or you swallow that wax? And I said, well, it says right in the Bible, I eat my honey with my honeycomb. He said, well, where does it say that? So I turned over there. Well, yeah, it does. Okay, pass the beeswax. But we watched them right there. The first time in their life they ever ate honey and locusts. You can ask Mr. Scotch about it sometime, you know. It was a little bitter out on the campouts. We tested everybody out. You know, there you catch live locusts and put them on a stick and roast them over the campfire and have locusts. You know, some people want to say, well, the Bible was talking about locust beans. No, it wasn't talking about locust beans. It's talking about those big yellow grasshoppers about that long. And you take their barbs off and their knee down, you know, and take off their head, and the other part comes out you don't want to eat, and then you roast them, and they taste just like peanuts. Now, I'll tell you, we may be eating locusts and wild honey in a place of safety, you know, because when those fires down in Arabia would, you know, when they'd have a drove of locusts that would be so black they'd blacken out the sky, they'd just build a big fire along, and then when those locusts would fly over this fire and get roasted, they'd go along and have a banquet right past the fire. So that's something they ate, and something John the Baptist ate. Well, it's good it isn't supper time. Ask Mr. Filippello about that. He's eating those locusts and wild honey, too. Well, anyway, come back here to where we're reading. But, you know, it would be healthy for you to begin to think of your wife as your spiritual sister. You know, God gives you the privilege of leading about a sister as a wife. You don't dare lord it over her. That's God's heritage. You remember that? You remember 1 Peter 5? Peter warned anybody in authority, not lording it over them as God's heritage, but being examples. So God didn't give you your wife as a piece of property you own, and she's not a second-rate citizen. She's not inferior to you. You know, men in the past have discussed why God said a woman is a weaker vessel. Well, he gives you all those reasons in that book of What Wives Wish Husbands Knew About Women. He gives you about 14 ways that women are the weaker vessel. And none of them are upstairs, you know. None of them are in the head. None of them are in character. None of them are in potential as far as God's family goes. So to me, that's an unbelievable beauty that Solomon keeps bringing back about his wife being his sister, his spouse, my sister. And notice he always says my sister first, and then my spouse secondly. Your lips, O my spouse, drop as a honeycomb. Honey and milk are under your tongue. Now there again, milk is one of the perfect foods. You know, milk is a calcium's a nerve food. And milk is one of the essentials. If God said a land flowing with milk and honey, you can't get any more perfect foods. You know, there aren't the two things that exist in nature that have all known food values that man has ever discovered. One of them is wheat, and the other one is milk. But he'll have something to say about wheat later. But notice going on then, how the woman's speech, how her counsel, how her romantic expressiveness to her husband is. Your lips drop as a honeycomb. Honey and milk are under your tongue. Now, how is that if you're arguing, if you're negative and sarcastic and, you know, Solomon said it's better to dwell in the corner of the housetop than with a nagging wife, or so contrast those and think about the perfection and the other opposite, the wrong. The smell of your garments is like the smell of Lebanon. There's just something even about the scent of somebody that they love, somebody's wife that they just enjoy. Just the natural smell, you know, the natural scent, not even the perfumed one, but just the person himself. A garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse. So now he likens his wife to the relaxing, inspiring beauty of walking in a garden of flowers and shrubs and trees and all enclosed in privacy and beauty. That's the way his wife is to him. A garden enclosed, a spring shut up, a fountain sealed, like the cold, pure refreshing of the spring water or a fountain. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates, with pleasant fruits, camphor with spikenard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes with all the chief spices. So here he's likening the various things that make up this beautiful garden that he's likening his wife to. A fountain of gardens, a well of living waters, and streams from Lebanon. Boy, you talk about appreciation for a wife. Almost the whole chapter, the man's been praising the wife. Now he says in verse 16, "Awake, O north wind, and come, you south, blow upon my garden, that the spices thereof may flow out. Let my beloved come into his garden and eat his pleasant fruits." So she responds to his expressiveness, and she wants him to come on back from his job and from his wanderings with the flocks. Of course, they've been in Lebanon, and that's north. Come back south, home, out of the north, where they've been on this lover's getaway, apparently, up in the mountains with the beauty of nature. Now, in chapter 5, here he answers her and says, "I am come into my garden, my sister, my spouse. I've gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb with my honey. I have drunk my wine with my milk. Eat, O friends. Drink, yea, drink abundantly, O beloved." And now he's likening his return home and his being back with his wife and his lover. And now, here's another help key listed right in here. You know, if someone's having a nightmare and they can't sleep and they're afraid they lost their mate and they're dreaming about hunting for them and they can't find them, and then the beauty when they come back. And here he says, take wine with milk, and that won't happen. You know, if you have a hard time sleeping, whether it's going through the change or whether it's just normal difficulty with sleeping, you in the evening drink a glass of wine and then through the same evening drink a glass of milk and you're going to sleep. Now, some people have used beer in the evening for a relaxant to help calm your nerves, to help as a sleeping agent, and it works. But your body develops, if you just take beer or wine by themselves, your body will develop where it will be able to handle it and it won't do the same thing. So it might work for you at first, but then you'll have to go off of it for a few weeks or a few months fasting, and then go back to it later and it'll work again. But you take wine with milk and it works forever. It works permanently. It doesn't have to be. Your body doesn't adjust to it where it'll take more and more, or where you'll have to go off of it for weeks or months and then get back to it. So if you take the honeycomb with the honey, you know, they've proven honeycomb relieves arthritis troubles, and honeycomb absorbs moisture out of your system. And, you know, there isn't any germ that can live in honey 3 minutes. Even impetigo, one of the toughest germs that exists, you can get impetigo on a piece of wood, and somebody can come by for a year and rub against it and get impetigo off of that. But you put any germ that you want in honey and it can't live even 3 minutes, because the honey absorbs the moisture out of the cells and they die. But when God talks about things in this nature, well, they're good to do. Eat the honey with the honeycomb. Drink wine with milk. Eat, old friends. Drink, yea, drink abundantly, old beloved. So apparently he's invited some of his friends over to enjoy his beautiful, perfect home and marriage. And now, after he's told her about the wine and the milk, then the comment is about not being able to sleep again. I sleep, but my heart wakes. It's the voice of my beloved that knocks, saying, open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my undefiled. Now, that's a beautiful thing to say, you know. But here she's dreaming again. And yet, it's as if she's awake, but it's just a dream. And here's her beloved, knocking and saying, let me in, my sister, my love. my dove, my undefiled. Well, that's beautiful to be able to say to your wife or to your husband, my undefiled, my dove, my love, my sister. For my head is filled with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. So this time, instead of coming after the day breaks, she's dreaming he's coming at night. So he's caught in the dew and gets wet. I've put off my coat. How shall I put it on? I've washed my feet. How shall I defile them? My beloved put in his hand by the hole of the door. My compassion and mercy were moved for him. I rose up to open to my beloved, and my hands dropped with myrrh, and my fingers with sweet-smelling myrrh upon the handles of the lock. You know, he couldn't call her and tell her when he's coming home, so she just had to be ready any time. So any night when she went to bed, she got herself ready, because how'd she know when he might just appear? You know, he always surprised her coming, so she kept herself ready any time. So here he's trying to get in, and she rises to let him in, and I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had withdrawn himself and was gone. My soul failed when he spake, so now she's showing how much she missed him when he was gone and how much she longed for him to be back. And she has this dream and gets up and opens the door, and he isn't there, and I sought him, but I couldn't find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer. So apparently here's someone else that's allowed to dream that they lost their mate, and how panicky they are, and how worried and troubled. And then when they find out it was only a dream, boy, what a relief, you know. The watchmen that went about the city found me. They smote me. They wounded me. The keepers of the walls took away my veil from me. So apparently here's another duality talking about the way Christ was treated. And yet, in the literal sense, they didn't help her find her lover, so they wounded her in that sense. They jostled her to awaken her up, smote her. They took away her veil, which women always use to keep anybody from being attracted by their beauty. Totally opposite in our world today, you know. That's a beautiful thing about back in the day when Isaac's wife was picked, and, you know, they didn't say, well, find the most beautiful, healthiest, you know, take your checkoff list and go up there and run an analysis of all those ladies and you'll find the one that's to be married to Isaac. That wasn't what happened at all. They wanted God to pick the one for Isaac. So the servant swore to Abraham, his master, I'll ask for someone to draw me water. And that way I'll know which one you've designated. And of course, she was kind. She even offered to water his animals. And of course, when she was being brought back to Isaac, she was veiled because she wanted to be sure he appreciated her for what she was, regardless of what she looked like. He didn't want her to flip over her looks. She wanted him to love her for what she was. And that was always true back then. That's why they had the veils for the women. And that's probably why Jacob didn't know the difference between Rachel and Leah when he worked 7 years for them. Now, it'd be dumb in our day, you know, because we do just the opposite. We want everybody to see everything available so they know what they're going to get and what they're looking for. And people get flipped over appearance and physique and everything, and that's wretched, you know. That's one of the big causes of our marriage problems. Now notice right away after she talks about this bad dream and the fear of losing her lover and the reality of not being able to find him, then she has another lesson for the daughters of Jerusalem. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him that I'm sick of love, or sick for love, that I'm missing him, and I need him back, and I want him. And so if you virgin daughters of Jerusalem see my beloved, then tell him to come home. I need him, that I want him back home. What is your beloved more than another beloved, O you fairest among women? So here apparently the daughters of Jerusalem are trying to find out why he's so special. Now maybe this is some citizens. Some people say there are four groups in the Song of Solomon. One is the citizens, and the other is the daughters of Jerusalem. So maybe this is just some of the citizens. Maybe it's some of these watchmen asking her, what makes her beloved more than any other beloved? O you fairest among women, what is your beloved more than another beloved that you do so charge us? Apparently there it's the daughters of Jerusalem speaking. Now she's going to tell them what it is about her beloved that makes him so special. My beloved is white and ruddy. The word there is Adam for red. Adam. Edom. The word ruddy or red. The chiefest among 10,000. His head is as the most fine gold. Now, how would you think of that? Well, the quality of gold, the value of gold, that's the way his brains are, that's the way his head is, his intellect, his mind power. His head is the most fine gold. His locks are bushy, curled, and black as a raven. His eyes are as the eyes of doves by the rivers of water. So they both speak of each other's eyes like doves' eyes, alive and active and washed with milk and fitly set. So they're white and matched, and his cheeks are as a bed of spices, as sweet flowers. His lips like lilies, dropping sweet-smelling myrrh. So the man's lips aren't meant to be a scarlet string like the woman's lips were, we read earlier. His lips are like lilies, dropping sweet-smelling myrrh. In other words, what they give off is sweet and encouraging and kind and gentle and understanding. His hands are as gold rings set with the beryl. His belly is as bright ivory overlaid with sapphires. So he's got strength in his loins even, you know, a strong, masculine shape. Not like we are in our day in 6,000 years of man's degeneracy. His legs are as pillars of marble, set upon sockets of fine gold. I remember watching a basketball game one time, and Guy Engelbart's wife said, "Boy, I'll tell you, my husband Guy has the best-looking legs in the ministry." Now, anybody else sitting around might have thought, "What was that? Did you hear what that preacher's wife said?" And, well, that shouldn't be embarrassing. You know, here it is in the book. A woman is telling the daughters of Jerusalem what it is about her man that makes him chief among 10,000. And she's telling, first of all, his brains. Then the appearance. He's handsome. His locks are bushy and black. His eyes are alive and reflect personality. Not dazed with drugs and beer and dope, you know. His cheeks are as a bed of spices. His lips like lilies, his hands as gold rings, his belly, his legs, his countenance is as Lebanon, excellent as the cedars, stately and dignified and cultured and sophisticated, not in the wrong sense. His mouth is most sweet, not gruff and negative and authoritarian and put down. His mouth is most sweet. Yea, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved, and this is my friend. Now, your mate ought to be your friend, your best friend, your beloved, O daughters of Jerusalem. So she's finished telling them now about what makes her lover so special. Whither is your beloved gone, O you fairest among women? So now they're asking her, where's your beloved gone? Where is your beloved turned aside that we may seek him with you? Well, my beloved has gone down into his garden to the beds of spices, to feed in the gardens and to gather lilies. I'm my beloved's. My beloved is mine. And he feeds among the lilies. Now, finally, the answer comes back from the man. You're beautiful. O my love, as Tirzah, comely as Jerusalem, terrible as an army with banners. So if you imagine Jerusalem from a distance, situated on a hill on the side of it, turn away your eyes from me, for they have overcome me. Your hair is as a flock of goats that appear from Gilead. Your teeth are as a flock of sheep which go up from the washing, whereof every one bears twins, and there's not one barren among them. So here he's describing, as he did again, the parallel, the symmetry of the beauty, the way God created the woman. As the piece of a pomegranate are your temples within your locks, healthy, rosy, red cheeks. There are 70 queens and 40 concubines and virgins without number. Now, of course, you know how many wives and concubines Solomon had, and yet there's only one that would make it perfect, and that's the one pictured here. My dove, my undefiled, is but one. She's the only one of her mother. She's the choice one of her that bare her. The daughter saw her, the other offspring of the same mother, and they too felt like this sister was the most desirable and the most attractive. The daughter saw her and blessed her. The queens and the concubines, they praised her. So this one wife was looked up to by all of them. Who is she that looks forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, terrible as an army with banners? I went down into the garden of nuts to see the fruits of the valley, and to see whether the vine flourished and the pomegranates budded. Wherever I was aware, my soul made me like the chariots of Amminadab. Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return. What may we look upon you? What will you see in the Shulamite? Of course, this is talking about this beautiful woman, the Shulamite. It means feminine or peaceful. What will you see in the Shulamite, as it were the company of two armies? How beautiful are your feet with shoes, O prince's daughter? The joints of your thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a cunning workman. Your navel is like a round goblet which wants not liquor. Your belly is like an heap of wheat set about with lilies. Your two breasts are like two young roes that are twins. Your neck is as a tower of ivory. Your eyes like the fish pools in Heshbon by the gate of Bathrabim. Your nose is as a tower of Lebanon which looks toward Damascus. So here's a man that's acquainted with geography and the Middle East and the things that are striking to a king, that are highlights of the physical realm, remind him of the beauty of his wife, whether it's her eyes or nose or whatever. Your head upon you is like Carmel, the hair of your head like purple. Royalty, the dignity of royalty. The king is held in the galleries. How fair and how pleasant are you, O love, for delight. This your stature is like to a palm tree, and your breast the clusters of grapes. Of course, the breasts in the Bible many times were pictured as nourishment or food for babies. I said, I'll go up to the palm tree, I'll take hold of the boughs thereof. Now also your breast shall be as clusters of the vine, and the smell of your nose like apples, the roof of your mouth like the best wine for my beloved that goes down sweetly, causing the lips of those that are asleep to speak. Then the woman answers again in verse 10, I am my beloved's, and his desires toward me. Come, my beloved, let us go forth into the field. Let us lodge in the villages. Let us get up early to the vineyards. Let us see if the vine flourishes, whether the tender grape appear, and the pomegranates bud forth. There will I give you my loves. The mandrakes give a smell, and at our gates are all manner of pleasant fruits, new and old, that I have laid up for you, O my beloved. So here again, they're taking a walk together and enjoying the beauty of the surroundings and enjoying each other's love in conjunction with that. Now here, the woman is speaking again. Oh, that you were as my brother that sucked the breasts of my mother. When I should find you without, I would kiss you Yea, I should not be despised. I would lead you and bring you into my mother's house, who would instruct me. So here again is the picture of how to be sure that you're not going to be misled or deluded and have the wisdom of a mother to help you in being sure you've got the right person. Now, maybe a mother has more of an ability to perceive the kind of a man that would make her daughters happy. You know, and I had three daughters, and I'm glad I didn't have to pick the mates for them, because I'm not too sure I'd have had the knowledge of what they would need most to make them the happiest. You know, I don't think I could have picked better husbands for my daughters, but I'm glad I didn't have to do the picking, because I'm not too sure I'd have been able to see the traits in the men that attracted the girls to them. Now, maybe a woman does have more of an ability to do that, and that's certainly suggested in here. You know, you'd almost think her mom's a widow. She doesn't say a word about her dad in here. She talks about bringing her to her mother's house and having her mother instruct her and getting her mother's counsel and wisdom and approval. And now, it doesn't say approval. Maybe that's where the dad would be brought into it as well. Now, apparently she's saying in verse 1 that she just wishes she could have shared her whole life with him from birth. No, it's certainly not saying, I wish you were my brother and I could marry my brother. You know, that's not what it's saying, that's for sure. Because that can only produce difficulties and complications. So apparently he's just saying here, when you really find the one that you really love, I know I used to always count how many years my wife's parents had her and how many years I had her. When I had her more years than they did, that set well with me. You know, I had her longer than they did then, and so I was happy about that. But maybe that's what she's doing here in verse 8, just wishing she could have had the enjoyment of this person's companionship from birth. But now she's going to get her mom's approval and okay as well. I would cause you to drink the spiced wine of the juice of my pomegranate. His left hand should be under my head. His right hand should embrace me. Of course, that's certainly a marriage scene there of love. And then she comes back once again, charging the daughters of Jerusalem. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you stir not up nor awake love. Now, leave the my out. That's italicized. That doesn't belong in there. So the one great lesson of the Song of Solomon is that young virgins or young maidens that are so captivated by marriage and a handsome, desirable, stately, kingly man should just be admonished about, don't stir up love, don't awaken love, you better leave the powers in your nature dormant until God brings the right one along for you, and then unload those on one another in marriage, and boy, you'll have a great marriage. But if you do everything before marriage that should be saved for after marriage, it's no wonder the number one question people ask marriage counselors is, why don't we love each other the way we used to? Well, you know, if you've done everything before marriage and with all kinds of different people, then what is there to make marriage such a powerful, tremendous thing? So I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you stir not up nor awake love until he plays. Until the time that God provides the right man. All right? Who is this that comes up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? Now, that's repeated from what we've read earlier. So here they're walking with their arms around each other's neck, coming up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved. I raised you up under the apple tree. There your mother brought you forth. There she brought you forth that bare you. So now this husband is boasting about how he's provided for her from the time she was the age of marriage, and how he, as the apple tree we read earlier, nourished her and sheltered her and protected her, and how he appreciated the job the mother did in bringing her up until time for marriage. And there the one that bare you brought you forth. You were given in marriage to me. Set me as a seal upon your heart. So now instead of the banner over them being love, now the man is set as a seal upon her heart, as a seal upon her arm, For love is strong as death. It's meant to last as long. It's meant to be as permanent. It's meant to be once. Love is strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. The coals thereof are coals of fire which have a most vehement flame. Many waters can't quench love, neither can the floods drown it. If a man would give all the substance of his house for love, it would utterly be contemned. You can't buy it. You can have billions and jillions of dollars. Which one of the millionaires was it said he'd give all his millions for one happy marriage? Is that Tommy Manville with the 11 wives? No, that was, he didn't have but 40, I guess, huh? Well, Solomon had many more than anybody could ever imagine, and yet God let him write the lesson about one woman for one man, and that's a hard way to learn it. Many waters can't quench love. The floods can't drown it. No, no man can buy it with all of his wealth. Now, it ends with a warning again about this sister, the wife, that had younger sisters that were daughters of Jerusalem, that they were trying to say, don't get love stirred up in your nature when you're just beginning to go through puberty or beginning to develop femininity, or when you're 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, or 18. We have a little sister, and she has no breast. What shall we do for our sister in the day when she shall be spoken for? If she be a wall, we will build upon her a palace of silver. In other words, hold out and don't give love like an open door. Hold out like a wall. If she be a door, we'll enclose her with boards of cedar. In other words, build a fence around these that are too young. Protect them, shelter them. Don't let them get their nature of passion or love stirred up before the time. I was a wall, and my breast like towers. Then was I in his eyes as one that found favor. So now the bride is beginning to look back and remember how she had been an undeveloped young girl before, and then she came to the development stage for marriage, and she says, I was a wall. In other words, she kept herself fenced in and walled off from lovers and aggressors, and I was a wall. And my breast like towers, then I was in his eyes as one that found favor because she kept herself for her husband. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He let out the vineyard and the keepers. Everyone for the fruit thereof was to bring 1,000 pieces of silver. So after she tells you a fact of history, now she likens in duality, my vineyard, which is mine, is before me. You, O Solomon, must have 1,000. Of course, he had 1,000 wives. And those that keep the fruit thereof, 200. You that dwell in the gardens, the companions, hearken to your voice, cause me to hear it. Make haste, my beloved, and be you like to a roe. So the last comment out of the woman's mouth again, after she's had this admonition to her little sisters, and look back when she was a younger girl before marriage, and how now she's Solomon's vineyard, as he had a literal vineyard. And now in ending, she says, hurry back home, my beloved. I long for you to come skipping on the mountains and be like the roe and the young hart on the mountains of spices, coming back to your wife and your home and your garden and your marriage. And well, I hope that's been helpful. Maybe it sneaking up on you and getting through it before you had to anticipate it all year. Maybe that'll take away a little bit of the message or bluntness of it, so I hope nobody's offended by it. It's Scripture. We need to all learn that so we can use that in the future, because that can be real helpful in the millennium.